Congressman Boehner, you have the floor.
The era of big government is back, and Democrats are asking you to pay for it.
Hey, they've all been asking us to pay for it. Government has been growing for every year of this century. Whatever the debate on Capitol Hill, big government never left. Is Congress up to tackling the challenging issues in the Obama budget? Big government, shrinking economy, at least someone's hiring. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry. Our friend Jerome Vaughn from WDET in Detroit is in for Adora Udoji. Good morning once again, Jerome.
Good morning, John. Coming up this hour, we'll break down the Obama budget outline. We'll also discuss governors who are turning down stimulus money and take a look at the role of American diplomatic envoys. All those stories and more coming up. Those stories. First, these headlines.
They say beauty is in the eye of the beholder, but in terms of President Obama's 2010 budget, that seems to depend on which side of the aisle you're on. Bipartisanship, right. Here's House Speaker Nancy Pelosi.
The budget is consistent with the president's message of accountability, fiscal responsibility, transparency.
But other members of Congress, like moderate Democrats Jim Cooper of Tennessee, says the budget's projected deficit of $1.2 trillion is ugly but realistic.
But I'm glad that the president's new budget is the most honest budget we've seen in a long, long time. Now, honest also means ugly, and a lot of Americans aren't used to politicians telling the truth. So in the choice between makeup or no makeup, I go for the natural look.
The budget proposes rolling back on tax cuts for couples earning $250,000 or more a year in 2011, and it also includes, for the first time, the costs of the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq.
The Treasury Department reached a deal late last night to change the terms of its loan to the bank Citigroup. The government will convert up to $25 billion of its preferred stock into common stock. That's a riskier investment. Meanwhile, mortgage holder Fannie Mae is looking for more government support as well. It says it needs $15 billion to restore its solvency. That's after posting more than $25 billion in fourth quarter losses. The president will be in North Carolina today to announce his plans to withdraw most American troops from Iraq by 2010, but he said yesterday in a closed-door meeting that up to 50,000 troops will stay behind to advise Iraqi forces.
Later on this morning, we'll hear the GDP from last quarter. It's expected to have shrunk more than 5%. Obama budget advisor Christina Romer says the U.S. economy will begin growing again by the end of the year.
Like most other forecasters, we anticipate that real GDP will fall significantly in the first quarter of this year. We expect it to bottom out sometime around mid-year 2009 and begin growing again by the end of the year.
That expected 5% shrinkage number is due out in about a half hour. GDP will be announced. And investors aren't going to love the new number. Right now, Dow futures are down. Meanwhile, the Dow and S&P fell more than 1% yesterday. Looks like a lower opening this morning, but the Dow opens today at 7182. The S&P opens at 753. If you've looked at the budget, if you looked at the outline anyway, the 140-page outline, what are your impressions? It's being described as a priority shift, some big vision, a lot of big numbers. Do you think these are the right priorities? Priorities, the right numbers. Tell us your thoughts at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
I go for the natural look.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. responsibilityproject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Large sums have been left off the books, including the true cost of fighting in Iraq and Afghanistan. And that kind of dishonest accounting is not how you run your family budgets at home. It's not how your government should run its budgets either. We need to be honest with ourselves about what costs are being racked up, because that's how we'll come to grips with the hard choices that lie ahead. And there are some hard choices that lie ahead.
The 10-year budget plan laid out yesterday by the Obama administration predicts a federal deficit of $1.75 trillion this year, nearly four times last year's record. The blueprint asks Congress to raise taxes on the wealthy to help stem the flood of red ink. It's criticized by some as being too light on spending cuts to combat the deficit and lauded by others for establishing a strong vision for the country's future. These priorities also highlight the future political fights, with few budget items that affect big farming, insurance companies, and drug makers. Big vision, big numbers, big political fight. John Harwood is the chief Washington correspondent at CNBC and a political writer for our partner, the New York Times. Good morning, John.
Good morning.
So, how much of a gamble is this new budget?
This is huge. You know, Barack Obama is someone we've all had a struggle of comprehension with him. What does he represent exactly? During the campaign, he talked about change. Nobody quite knew what that meant. During the transition, he made a bunch of appointments that people interpreted as moderate, and so many people said it will be a kind of a temperate presidency. What we see in this document is the ambition within this young leader to both transform energy policy, education, health care, do it all while trying to lift the economy out of recession, stabilize the financial industry, and do it all at the same time. Any of these priorities would be enough for one Congress all on its own, and he's trying to do them all very rapidly. I remember a senator when Bill Clinton's presidency started, he said, buckle your seatbelt, it's going to be a real ride. I think this is going to be an even bigger ride, although in a different way on policy, because he's trying to take on so much.
Now, can this Congress handle that weight?
We don't know whether they can. We know that, for example, one of his ambitions, you mentioned in the setup piece that some people criticize this budget for a lack of spending cuts, and that's a fair charge. One of the things Barack Obama wants to take on is the solvency of entitlement programs, Medicare and Social Security. Democratic members of Congress are pushing back against his desire for quick action on Social Security. Why? Because that would involve benefit cuts. So here is the conundrum. How does he keep his party with him? How does he keep the country with him? Do enough to get Republicans to join in so that you can make some of these transformational steps, which require both parties to participate. It's a huge challenge.
You know, John, I'm just wondering, and many congressional historians have written about this, that really over the last 20 years, Congress has removed itself from serious legislative law creation. There's been a lot of tweaking, a lot of sort of symbolic debates, but Congress doesn't really have the mechanical sort of oomph anymore to do what was done back in the 1960s under Lyndon Johnson, huge shifts in policy like the Civil Rights Act, Voting Rights Act, those kinds of things. Aside from merely getting the arithmetic to work, keeping your party in line, is Congress in a position to even approach some of these issues and get real law passed?
Well, I disagree to this extent. I don't think it's an issue of mechanics. The Congress has shown that it can act when it has the will to do so. But the question is the will. One of the reasons why Congress has not legislated over the last two decades in so many instances is because of the even balance of power between these two very ideologically distinct parties. That still remains, even though Democrats have a majority. So one of the things that Barack Obama says in terms of trying to bring the country together is that he can surmount some of that gridlock. That's why the outreach to Republicans, even if it wasn't rewarded in the stimulus debate, is something that's highly important to his political prospects. So he is going to have Republican support for health care, for entitlement reform. If he can marshal that, if he can keep the public heat on the Congress, they can act. The question is, do they have the will to do so?
Does we have to do something, which is sort of the Obama message from earlier this week, we have to get together and do something? Does that become the ideology in this crisis environment and the fine points of whether tax cuts are better or whether the deficit is really bad? Does that fade into the background?
Well, I think you're exactly right, and it's interesting with the question of ideology. So many times when you talk to people like David Axelrod, the chief strategist for Barack Obama, he'll say Barack Obama is not an ideological guy. He's having a practical response to the problems we face. When you look at this budget document that came out yesterday, there is ideology in there. This is a president who wants to use the power of government to solve public problems. That is what we conventionally think of as liberal or left. But he has the advantage of a crisis to be able to say, I'm not doing this for ideological reasons. I'm doing it because it's practical for the circumstances that we face. If you can sell that argument, you keep people in the center of the political spectrum with you, you improve your prospects for succeeding.
You know, there's an interesting strategy question here in the budget. You know, one of the things that the stimulus package was criticized about is that it didn't contain big ideas, visionary sorts of calls for change. The budget does contain that. In a sense,
no kidding.
it might have been a really swift move to keep the ideology and the sort of vision stuff out of stimulus and put it in the budget.
Well, again, this is the challenge of comprehension. He campaigned for most of these things during 2008. It's just that our attention is selective at particular times, and when we match up what he's saying against what Hillary Clinton was saying or what John McCain was saying. But this cap-and-trade program, which he is advocating, he campaigned on. The health care plan, which he put this $630 billion down payment on in this budget. He campaigned on that. The same with his education proposals. It's just when you gather it all together and when you present it to Congress so early in your presidency, having already gotten $800 billion out of the Congress, it looks incredibly dramatic. And you're right, the stimulus package looks a little quotidian compared to the details of this budget and the ambition to reshape domestic policy.
Thanks so much, John, for joining us.
My pleasure.
John Harwood, chief Washington correspondent of CNBC and a political writer for The New York Times.
Boy, listening to Harwood there, the campaign seems like it happened years ago, back then when those people were campaigning. It just seems like a million years ago. One more thought on the budget. We're joined now by Matthew Bishop from The Economist and author of Philanthrocapitalism, How the Rich Can Save the World. The taxes being raised in this budget outline that was proposed yesterday by the president will come to people above the $250,000 a year income level. The question is, are the rich partners in the Barack Obama administration to raise the money necessary to reduce the deficit and finance some of these programs, or are they the target who are going to be soaked to actually finance the Obama program? Matthew Bishop, which do you think it is?
Well, I think it's a bit of both, actually. I think on the one hand, Obama is having, in the first round of his budget proposals, to really hit the rich very hard with tax increases. Now, the reality is that if he's going to be pushing through the sort of budget he's talking about, those tax increases are not going to be anywhere near enough, particularly if there aren't the spending cuts that we would hope to see. So it's going to be even more taxation to come, I suspect. On the other hand, he is someone who has a lot of very, very wealthy supporters who funded him in a big way in the campaign, who must have signed up for his progressive tax agenda when they backed him, and also that he wants to embrace an agenda of social innovation with things like charter schools, and he's going to create a White House Office of Social Innovation, which is about, in some respects, partnering with wealthy what I call philanthrocapitalists, to actually be more innovative in government. And that means that if it works, you won't just get bigger government, you'll also get smarter government, because the real worry here is that you get bigger, stupider government.
You know, the Bush administration was accused by Barack Obama at some times of having an open door for rich people, and that they got advantages from access to the Bush administration. This is a different kind of open door policy to wealthy individuals in this social entrepreneurship you're talking about.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at cities like New York and Washington to some extent, you've got reforming mayors who have really worked very closely with philanthropists to fund innovative new approaches to things like schools and, sort of getting the poorest people to get proper health care and immunization and so forth. And I think that the Obama administration will try and do that at a federal level with this new office in the White House.
Well, it's exactly what the administration was talking about, taking what works, as you said, with some of these progressive mayors and translating it to the federal level. Matthew Bishop, thanks so much. The Economist, from The Economist, and he's author of Philanthrocapitalism, How the Rich Can Save the World. Thank you, Matthew.
We'll be right back.
email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. Well, once you're confirmed as Secretary of State, you get down to business. And in Hillary Clinton's case, you start naming envoys.
Ambassador Holbrook will coordinate across the entire government an effort to achieve United States strategic goals in the region.
Ambassador Richard Holbrook, the envoy to the region, South Asia, particularly Afghanistan and Pakistan. Another envoy? Sure.
He will lead our efforts to reinvigorate the process for achieving peace between Israel and its neighbors.
No more calls. We have a winner. That's Hillary Clinton talking about George Mitchell, who will be the special ambassador to the Middle East. Two hotspots, two envoys. We have a former envoy joining us today, Dan Simpson, now an editor at the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, served as U.S. special envoy to Somalia from 1994 to 1995. He joins us from WDUQ in Pittsburgh. Welcome to the show, Dan.
Thank you very much. It's nice to be with you.
I gather I should call you ambassador. You were also in the diplomatic corps when Zaire, Congo was Zaire.
You can call me Dan. That's perfect. Yeah, I was sent ambassador to the Central African Republic and then Somalia. I was ambassador and special envoy and then to Zaire, which re-became the Democratic Republic of Congo while I was there.
Well, what are the responsibilities of an envoy, especially in a place that is so in flux? I mean, Somalia couldn't have been more in flux at the time that you went in.
Yes, I would say that in general, special envoys are named when a problem is especially difficult, and particularly if it's cross-national, which is to say that it goes across borders. And, of course, that is the case with George Mitchell and Dick Holbrooke and now Steve Bosworth to North Korea.
And I mean, do you have a special portfolio? I mean, are you carrying a clear message that you're reporting directly to the Secretary of State or even to the President?
Well, that kind of depends on the magnitude of the problem. I think the first thing that's different about it is it's usually a cross-national issue, one which, you know, involves either a number of countries or a number of parties to a conflict. I think that the reason special envoys are named is that the problem is considered to be different in character and beyond the capacities of the normal diplomatic corps. You know, an American ambassador is ambassador to a country, whereas, for example, right now, looking at what George Mitchell has to tackle, you know, he has to face Israel and
it's enormous.
Palestinian elements, and other Arabs are really quite interested, and then everybody else in the world virtually is interested.
I mean, he's got two parties even within the Palestinians. You know, this goes back to the shuttle diplomacy era of Philip Habib, who went back and forth to negotiate peace agreements. How far have we come in the sort of envoy game from the Philip Habib days?
Well, I would say that for one thing, the problems are much more complex. I mean, if one looks at what George Mitchell and, of course, also Holbrooke have to tackle. I mean, Holbrooke, it's Pakistan and Afghanistan. I mean, if one looks at that, I'd say the problems are more complex. Also, for better or for worse, these are old problems, and they are older now, and older tends to mean more complex, which is to say that people are dug in more deeply in their positions, and there's more history, some of which is unfortunate.
Now, in the United States, when a president names an envoy, you know, the news media tends to think, okay, well, we're bumping up the priority of this problem by naming an envoy. But do people in the world, in the countries that are involved, do they view an envoy as sort of a bumping up of interest, or a kind of a, here comes another clown.
Oh, boy,
clown.
Here comes old you-know-who.
There you go.
Well, it's a little complicated because particularly now, people, foreign countries, foreign leaders want the attention of our new president, who's a bit of a superstar, and of course Hillary Clinton, the Secretary of State, who's also a superstar. And so when you tell them, oh, well, you know, we're going to turn your problem over to Steve Bosworth or Dick Holbrooke, why they think, now, wait a second here. Now, the way to beat that, there are two ways to beat that. One of them is that the special envoy himself or herself must stay in close touch with the ROC. You know, they need to be in touch with Obama and say, well, you know, the other day when I was talking to the president about your problem, he told me, you know, X and Y.
Right.
The other way is that the other line of communication, which is to say that president to president, you know, Obama calls Mahmoud Abbas or, you know, something like that. That remains.
Sorry, I mean, I guess it's a coordinated effort. We have to go, but the president really has to be involved behind the scenes, and the special envoy cannot be removed either from the president or from the world leaders that he or she is dealing with. Dan Simpson is an editor at the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. He served as U.S. special envoy to Somalia. There was a challenging job from 1994 to 1995. Thanks for joining us, Dan. And now Femi Okeh has some headlines.
Thank you, John. The time is just coming up to 28 minutes past the hour. Fannie Mae is looking for more support from the Treasury in the wake of fourth quarter losses. The mortgage giant says that it lost more than $25 billion in the final 3 months of 2008 as credit and real estate markets continue to decline. Fannie Mae is now asking the government for another $15 billion to help fill its deficit. Today, President Obama is going to a Marine camp in North Carolina to announce his strategy in Iraq. His administration says that most combat troops will stay through the end of this year to help the elections go smoothly, but around 90,000 of those troops will be gone by next summer. That timetable is a little slower than the president's campaign promise, but still speeds up the U.S. withdrawal. Meanwhile, in Iraq, Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki wants to diversify his country's economy away from oil. At the moment, oil sales make up more than 90% of the country's revenue. Iraq is worried that low prices will not generate enough money to rebuild the country without increased production. After 150 years, the Rocky Mountain News publishes its last paper today. Colorado's oldest newspaper is closing after it couldn't find a buyer.
It's so sad. I mean, it's a great paper. Yeah. Did you ever read it? I mean, it's a tabloid.
I've never seen it.
It's a tabloid paper.
Yeah.
They're, I think, the first to have color in the Colorado area. It circulated all over the West. I used to read it when I lived down in Oregon.
Well, this is very touching. This is the Daily's editor, John Temple. He was talking about the staff in the newsroom and how they're reacting to the news of the paper closing down today.
People are, you know, in grief. And they're very, very upset in this, you know, trying to process all the emotions that go with it and recognize that we're putting out our final edition.
Wow. And last year, the newspaper lost $16 million, so you can understand why it's not financially viable anymore. That's looking at your news for now.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of auto insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
One of the things that's been mixed in with all the congressional talk about budget and stimulus is the jobless rate. The number of people without jobs keeps growing, but governors in nine states, mostly in the South, are considering rejecting millions of dollars in federal stimulus money for increased unemployment insurance. Here's Mississippi Governor Haley Barbour.
I am going to not take all the money because of the requirement under the unemployment insurance compensation section would force us to raise taxes when the federal money runs out.
Michael Luo is a reporter for the New York Times. He joins us on the line. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning.
Explain to us why these governors are looking to reject additional funds for jobless benefits in the midst of this economic crisis.
Yeah, essentially some of them are saying that it doesn't make sense because after this money runs out, and it could be 2 or 3 years, it could be longer in other cases, they'll be paying the bill for these benefits, and they're saying that that would cause them to raise taxes.
Do they have some sort of backup plan to take care of their constituents if they don't take this money?
Well, I mean, these benefits are applied to very specific cases right now. I mean, it doesn't mean that anyone right now who gets benefits is going to lose them. What it is they expand benefits in certain criteria. Like, just one example is, in a lot of states, if you're only available to work part-time, you're not eligible for unemployment benefits. And so what this money does is it offers an incentive to these states to open up some of their eligibility requirements and change some of the rules to cover some of those people. And so simply what it means is, in these states, those people, say like the part-time worker example, they just wouldn't get the benefits. But in other states that are taking the money and are willing to change their rules to abide by it, they would.
Here's one of the people that hopes not to get bitten. This is Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal.
This will result in an increase in taxes on our businesses. This will result in a permanent obligation on the state of Louisiana. It would be like spending a dollar to get a dime.
Now, Michael, does that ring true for you? I mean, is that really something that you go, oh, okay, that makes sense to me?
Arguments against that, what they're saying. So, like I said, they could revisit this. The other thing that proponents of expanding these benefits point out is a lot of these states, this is kind of complicated, but a lot of these states, their payroll taxes that pay for unemployment insurance are tied to the level of money that's in their unemployment insurance trust fund. But a lot of states' unemployment trust funds are running low at this point. And so that would trigger an automatic tax increase in some states to address that. But what this money would do, we would send millions of dollars flowing now into these trust funds that are low right now, and that could actually prevent them from having to raise taxes right now. And so there are basically arguments on both sides.
Well, you know, that's the real head-scratcher, though, Michael. I mean, what is the precedent for governors standing in the way of a river of federal money when the tangible benefits are really evident to people who actually vote?
In the story so far, people have been writing about what these governors are doing, but no one's really gone out because it's kind of very specific, like who are affected, like the real lives are affected. So I went out and tried to find some of these people, and I managed to find some of them. And this guy I was talking to in Texas was talking about Governor Rick Perry, and said, you know, this governor is taking money hand over fist from the Bush administration for all kinds of purposes, and so why is he all of a sudden standing in the way of, you know, this? This is a relatively minor portion of the stimulus package, and his conclusion is it's got to be politics.
A quick question here. You know, do you see that the people who are, thinking about this are going to be affected by this? Are they angry enough to change the political balance in those states?
I'm not sure. I mean, there was some talk. When I was working on the story, I called around to a lot of unions, which aren't that strong in a lot of these states. But and there was some talk of organizing on this and some rallies. The thing about it is, this is really complicated. Actually, the people who are directly affected by this, These rules in unemployment eligibility are very difficult to explain in some cases, and so it definitely wouldn't be a matter of the workers who are directly affected by it, but it could be sort of jobless workers more broadly organized and being upset about this.
Michael, we appreciate you being on the show. That is the New York Times' Michael Luo reporting on governors who are considering rejecting millions of dollars in federal stimulus cash.
It's really amazing to consider just the pressure situation that they're in. It's a high-stakes game. And now we have headlines from Femi Okeh.
Thank you very much, John. The time is just coming up to 22 minutes to the top of the hour. Also getting in this hour, some new GDP figures. According to the government, the economy has shrunk faster than expected, the pace 6.2 in the last quarter. That's the worst in a quarter of a century. And let me just give you a little bit of perspective here. The GDP is the country's most comprehensive economic indicator. So what it does is it represents the total value of the country's production during a set period of time. So the 6.2% shrinkage was just in the last couple of months of last year.
The last couple of seconds, the Dow futures just slipped below 2%. So the market is expected to open much lower this morning.
Thanks for that financial update there, John. Talking about finance, President Obama's first budget for next year offers plenty of goals for Congress. The $3.6 trillion package contains ambitious plans to change healthcare, energy, farm payments, taxes, and many, many more other financial incentives. The president says that it will also make government spending more efficient.
We're going to go through our books page by page, line by line, to eliminate waste and inefficiency. This is a process that will take some time, but in the last 30 days alone, we have already identified $2 trillion in deficit reductions that will help us cut our deficit in half by the end of my first term.
Congressional Democrats have talked up the new budget, and Republicans say it won't work. The chief investment officer of Stanford Financial Group is due in federal court today. Laura Pendergast Holt was arrested in Houston yesterday. She's accused of obstructing an SEC investigation of an alleged $8 billion investment fraud, and that fraud was involving Texas billionaire Alan Stanford. Stanford is facing civil charges of lying about investments. Facebook is trying its hand at democracy. Yesterday, its founder, Mark Zuckerberg, said that users will get some say in determining the policies on privacy, ownership, and sharing. The 175 million users around the world will also get to comment and vote on changes before they're put in place. Earlier this week, Facebook was slammed with online protests arguing about the site's policies, and it was really about who owned the information that you put out there about yourself. Was it you? Or was it Facebook?
Well, Facebook wanted to own it, and now they're saying, okay, you guys have all the control. That was quite a turnaround.
Yeah, very fast indeed.
Thank you, Femi.
Let's look at big stories making news for you this morning.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Jerome Vaughn, in for Adora Udoji.
Thanks, Jerome, and I'm John Hockenberry. As the large industrial nations of the world struggle in this economic environment, smaller nations, particularly in East Asia, are looking for some innovative ways to pick up the slack as larger nations are too strapped just to provide support traditionally. The Association of Southeast Asian Nations, or ASEAN, is an organization known more for symbolic posturing, not so much for its action. It dates from the Vietnam era, but they're holding a summit in Thailand today, and it's going to be an innovative program that East Asian finance ministers are putting together to try and stabilize their own currencies. These are currencies that are under severe pressure in this environment. For more, we turn to BBC correspondent Jonathan Head in Bangkok. And when we spoke earlier this morning, I asked Jonathan to describe what the finance ministers of these East Asian nations are planning to do on their own and how innovative this possible plan would be if it gets implemented.
It's a long-term project. It goes right the way back to the Asian financial crisis of 1997-98, when a lot of the countries in this region had severe banking and currency crises, somewhat similar. They were asset bubbles, too, to what you're experiencing in the United States now and in Europe. And they were given a lot of very stern advice by the IMF, which came in and told them what they had to do A lot of them didn't like being dictated to by the IMF and felt its advice was inappropriate. So they're, in a sense, what they're really talking about is developing an Asian monetary fund, a rival to the IMF. They're not calling it that. They're making it very clear this will parallel the IMF, that it'll work together with the IMF. But you've got to remember that things are very different now for Asia than they were 11 years ago. These countries have very substantial currency reserves, about three-quarters of the world's foreign currency reserves, huge numbers of US dollar reserves, are held here in Asia, China being the largest. And they're saying, if we've got all those foreign currency reserves, surely we're the ones who can stabilize our currencies if there's another crisis. But this is an early stage. They're saying it'll be about $120 billion is what they're aiming for at the moment. And there's an awful lot of detail they've got to hammer out about how much each country contributes. They're almost there on that. And more crucially, what the rules are if a country gets into trouble and it goes to this fund for assistance to stabilize its currency. But we aren't seeing the first beginnings of talk about an alternative to the IMF.
What do you think the response to that would be? I mean, on the one hand, a competitor to the IMF might be viewed as something of a threat to the organization, but it also might reduce pressure on the IMF if regional currency stabilization funds were there to help out nations such as Thailand.
Well, it's interesting how attitudes have changed. When this was first proposed at the height of the Asian crisis in 1997 by the Japanese, the then Deputy US Treasury Secretary, one Larry Summers, shot it down very fast. The US at that time did not want anything to undermine the IMF. It was deeply suspicious. It felt an Asian fund would be very soft and wouldn't demand that people restructured their banks. Things have really changed, and there's a recognition, I think, in the US now that with all these currency reserves in Asia, they are in a position to do a lot more to stabilize themselves, that the IMF does have limited reserves and it has lost some credibility. So it's far less opposed, and they are making it very clear this will not replace the IMF. In fact, they're saying if this fund gets going, countries that receive any money from it will have to abide by IMF rules as well, and that the IMF will be involved in that process.
Well, that's a takeaway. The IMF provides the rules, the nations provide the currency, and the regional proximity of the institution to all the threatened nations actually provides some efficiencies of its own. My guest was the BBC's Jonathan Head. Jonathan spoke to us from Bangkok in an interview conducted earlier this morning on The Takeaway.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. Too many boys in this show, you know? Coming up, we're going to have a look at diversity in the judiciary from some women legal experts. And now, thankfully, the female voice of Femi Oke here.
Some estrogen, finally.
Finally.
Although the control room might say I have more testosterone than estrogen, but that's another story.
Get into that.
We don't have time for that. 12 minutes to the top of the hour. So we just learned that the economy shrank at a rate of 6.2% last quarter. That's a much faster speed than experts were expecting. They had forecast predictions of around about 5.4%. There's a new deal between the Treasury Department and Citigroup. It means the government will now control up to 36% of the bank's common stock. The deal does not involve putting more tax dollars into the bank. The shift should give the bank more capital, which should allow it to increase lending. Mortgage holder Fannie Mae is looking for more government support as well. It says that it needs $15 billion to restore its solvency, and that's after posting more than $25 billion in fourth quarter losses. Forensic experts are now working to identify the dead from a Turkish Airlines plane that crashed near Amsterdam's main airport on Wednesday. At least four of the nine people who were killed are believed to be Americans. Investigators are still unsure about what caused the crash. An analysis of the plane's data recorders could be completed today, but results probably won't be out until next week. That's your estrogen. Now back to the testosterone.
Thanks so much, Femi. As America has become more diverse, many of its law schools and law firms have followed suit. But some say the pipeline to the judiciary is blocked. White males are overrepresented as state judges by a margin of nearly 2-1. Joining us now is Char Torres-Spellacy, the co-author of a recent study looking at how to make the judiciary more diverse. We also have a newly appointed judge in Columbus, Ohio, Kim Cocroft. Welcome, Char. First of all, why is judicial diversity so important?
Well, the way I look at it is courts are missing out on a vast pool of talent. We also want diversity to increase the legitimacy of the courts in the eyes of an increasingly diverse public. And finally, the jurisprudence may benefit from adding new perspectives that diverse judges can bring to the court.
So, but, you know, is this a degree of political correctness as well? I mean, do we see demonstrated that judges who are women or minorities really make a difference?
I think they do bring a unique perspective. If we look at, for example, the federal judiciary and the Supreme Court, I think you could argue that having Sandra Day O'Connor on the court made a difference in the jurisprudence that came out of her court. She was often the swing vote, and in her absence, we see the difference in what the Roberts Court has, the cases and how they've decided them.
Tell us a little bit about what you found out in your study.
Well, we looked at gender and racial diversity in 10 states that appoint their judges. And one of the things that sort of jumped off the page for us is 4 of the 10 states that we studied had all white Supreme Courts. And those states are Arizona, New Hampshire, Rhode Island, and Utah. Now, there's some difference in the demographics in those states. In New Hampshire, you might not be terribly shocked to have an all-white bench because it's a very white state. But when you have a state like Arizona, which is about 40% non-white, having an all-white Supreme Court is a little bit more jarring.
So what is it that you found that's preventing greater diversity in these states?
In part, I think it's that the judicial nominating commissions who are charged with making the short list that goes to the governor, they often don't have a mandate to go out and recruit the way that, say, top law firms in this country recruit. So instead, they wait for the applicant pool to come to them. And judicial openings are sort of odd. Sometimes they occur on very odd cycles because a current judge has died or a current judge has sort of decided for personal reasons to step down. So, you know, the pool of lawyers who could become judges may not even realize that an opening is on the court.
Now, you know, are we talking about, I guess, on a different level? Are we talking about indifference to the issue, or are we talking about at sometimes active bias?
What we think is going on is not active bias, but what cognitive scientists call implicit bias. There's some really outstanding work that's coming out of Harvard where they have basically come to the conclusion that there are these biases that we pick up in childhood. And so if, as a four-year-old, you thought only white men are judges, many people carry that view into their adulthood without even realizing it. And the other thing that the cognitive scientists have sort of shown us is that if you show people that they have this bias, then they can sort of self-correct it. But when you sort of ignore that it could be a possibility, then you're likely to, you know, even if your whole job is being a judicial nominating commissioner and your job is to diversify your bench, if you sort of have this implicit bias sort of undermining your choices, you may end up appointing white men again and again and again.
Kim Cocroft is on the line from Columbus, Ohio. Kim, tell us about your experience. How did you break through that barrier? How did you get appointed to the bench?
Well, first, thank you for having me this morning. In Ohio, Governor Strickland developed, when he took office in 2007, a recommendation process. It's called the Ohio Judicial Appointment Recommendation Panel. And that what he wanted to do in developing this panel was, as Chara has indicated, open up the possibility of having more diverse candidates apply for judicial vacancies around the state of Ohio. And so that's how I came to apply for the position that I'm going to take on April the 6th. It was an open process. The three criterion that are attendant to this process for applicants are that, first, they must have an ability to serve fairly and impartially. The second is that they must bring a diverse background and perspective to the bench. And then third, they must demonstrate an ability to run successfully for election if they are selected. And so when I saw those criterion, I thought, why not take the chance? And so I decided to apply, and it worked out well.
Now, the governor's received some criticism for appointing you and another young African-American woman to the bench over white men considered to be more experienced. What's your response?
I certainly respect the opinion of those who disagree with Governor Strickland's selection. I think that there's more that goes into being a good judge beyond experience. I think you have to have the right temperament. I think you have to have good analytical skills. And I think it's important that the bench reflect the diversity of litigants that are going to come before our courts. And so while I appreciate those concerns, I think that both Ms. Beatty and myself are qualified and ready to do the job.
Now, this... Go ahead.
I'm sorry, and we'll bring a fresh perspective to the court. So we're excited about the opportunities.
Now, with the election of President Obama and his wife, Michelle, both black lawyers, will that have a galvanizing impact on diversity in the judiciary?
I think for me it has. I think that they were both catalysts for my decision to apply for this position. President Obama and First Lady Obama have hearkened Americans to greater levels of service, and so I think that serving on the judiciary is one of the highest forms of service that a lawyer can undertake. And so I think that as people have more confidence in themselves and see what President and First Lady Obama have accomplished, I think that you're going to start to see a change in the composition of judiciaries across the country.
Thanks very much, Kim Cocroft. As of April 1st, will be a judge in the Franklin County Court in Columbus, Ohio. Chara Torres-Spellacy is an attorney at the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU's School of Law. Thank you both for joining us this morning.
President Obama's budget is out. We're following it all day. Do you think its priorities are the right ones? What do you think of the numbers? Do the math. Think about the policy and tell us your thoughts at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. And speaking of the budget, here's your takeaway.
What we see in this document is the ambition within this young leader to both transform energy policy, education, healthcare, do it all while trying to lift the economy out of recession, stabilize the financial industry, and do it all at the same time.
It's John Harwood from CNBC and our partner, the New York Times. If you missed anything on the program, like that interview with Harwood, take our podcast to go. You can subscribe now at the website, thetakeaway.org. We should remind you, GDP shrank at a much higher than expected rate of 6.2%. That's the big story we're also following today. And while you're at our site, check out our videos, too, where you can watch Jerome School me on the towns around our newest station, WDET in Detroit. And I don't think I will ever be able to say Hamtramck right. It looks like Hamtramck needs to buy a vowel, that town.
Hamtramck, you've got it.
Thank you.
I'm Jerome Vaughn, in for Adora Udoji.
I learned something this week. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
Hey, so what about this? Instead of letting all that hot gas escape out of the tailpipe and up the chimney, let's sell it.
Blowing secondhand smoke, trying to provoke me. But I can see through what you're trying to do. So let me take a second to clear the air so it doesn't choke me. And then we'll both be able to see.
That's right. A plan for selling the carbon emissions we all put into the atmosphere is how the Obama administration is going to pay for some tax cuts and renewable energy projects. There's $150 billion in that smoke.
The only breath that I have is circulating through my lungs. I exhale the hip-hop.
Inhale, exhale. How much is it worth to you? Carbon bling on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. Carbon bling, it's for real. I mean, diamonds are just carbon, right? I'm John Hockenberry. Our friend Jerome Vaughn from WDET in Detroit is in for Adora Udoji. Good morning, Jerome.
Good morning, John. Coming up this hour, we'll look at how a follower of Al-Qaeda may face terrorism-related charges in U.S. federal court. We'll also check in on the GDP's shrinkage in the last quarter. Those stories coming up, but first, let's take a look at the top headlines.
And the top headline does refer to that GDP. The economy shrank at a rate of 6.2% last quarter. It's the worst showing in a quarter century, a much faster rate than experts expected. They'd forecasted predictions of about 5.4%. The GDP represents the total value of the country's production and is the nation's most comprehensive economic indicator. Investors don't like the new number either. Dow futures are way down. The Obama team said yesterday that his budget for 2010 is based on the assumption that the economy will begin growing again by the end of the year. In the meantime, it has plenty of Republicans seeing red. Here's Texas Congressman Jeb Hensarling.
The budget should have been printed in red ink instead of black ink. You know, American families are hurting. They're having to tighten their belt. The least Washington could do is level fund the government from one year to the next. There's no history of a nation borrowing and spending its way into prosperity.
Among the many things proposed in the budget, it rolls back tax cuts for couples earning $250,000 or more in the year 2011.
The Treasury Department reached a deal late last night to change the terms of its loan to Bank Citigroup. The government will convert up to $25 billion of its preferred stock into common stock. That's a riskier investment. Meanwhile, mortgage holder Fannie Mae is looking for more government support as well. It says it needs $15 billion to restore its solvency. That's after posting more than $25 billion in fourth quarter losses. The president will be in North Carolina today to announce his plans to withdraw most American troops from Iraq by 2010. He said yesterday in a closed-door meeting that up to 50,000 troops will stay behind to advise Iraqi forces.
A center-right coalition in Israel is off the table. The leader of Israel's centrist party, Zippy Livni, says she won't join a government led by conservative Benjamin Netanyahu. The Dow and S&P both fell more than 1% yesterday and look for continued downward movement as the markets open in about a half hour. The S&P begins trading at 753. So if you've read the budget, if you've heard about it, if you've slept on it and thought about it, give us your impressions, 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. There are big programmatic visions in that budget and some pretty large numbers. Do the math, think about the policy. Give us your thoughts at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
An alleged follower of Al-Qaeda may soon face terrorism-related charges in U.S. federal court. The move would eliminate the possibility of a military tribunal. It would also give the only man designated as an enemy combatant to be held in the continental United States some of the legal options available in civilian criminal court. Joining us is John Schwartz, national legal correspondent for our partner, The New York Times. He's writing a story on the case in tomorrow's paper. Run down the story for us, John.
Well, you've got this fella named Al-Mari, Ali Al-Mari. And Al-Mari was picked up, got to the country on September 10th, 2001. People were suspicious of him, especially after September 11th. There were things about him that seemed unusual, the way he got to America came to Chicago and then asked to be taken to Peoria and in a taxi cab with his family, and then started setting up what appear to be shell businesses. And so he was arrested in December of 2001, and what the government says about him is that he is an enemy combatant, that he did actually meet with Osama bin Laden and say, you know, I want to work for you. And Mr. Omari denies all this, but before the criminal charges on basically identity theft and fraud were heard, he was moved to a brig in Charleston, South Carolina, and he has been kept in that sort of twilight zone state since then. And so the move to a criminal court completely changes the case, but also might suggest a change in the way the Obama administration is going to look at this practice of putting people away.
How significant is it that we're looking at a possible new way to deal with this issue?
Well, the intriguing thing is that Jose Padilla, who was the fellow who they initially accused of wanting to create a dirty bomb, that Padilla was also in this kind of detention, indefinite detention, and was also then shifted to the criminal court. So the question, and the Bush administration was accused at that time of trying to move the question off the table, get this guy out of the extraordinary legal condition that the Bush administration had come up with. And so the Bush administration was accused of simply trying to change the subject and get the difficult questions out of the way. And Padilla was convicted on terrorism-related charges. In the case of Mr. Omari, the question is the Obama administration doing this, again, just to keep the issues of this kind of being held without access to lawyers and everything, to take it off the table, to keep the Supreme Court, which has agreed to hear the case in April, from having to deal with these issues and maybe foreclose options? Or does it show that the administration is trying to change the law and trying to get to the sort of openness and transparency that President Obama has promised? And until we see what happens in this trial, we won't know.
Well, it's interesting, John, because you point out that until the Supreme Court rules, it's possible that the Obama administration has some wiggle room here. And I'm wondering if you can see from the way this case is being handled anything that might be, being taken from the Bush experience, any part of the detention or the procedural strategies that the Justice Department used under the Bush administration is going to be taken up by the Obama administration. And at the very least, it appears as though for all these detainees, their original detention amounts to a kind of secret pretrial sort of domain that's a complete netherworld. If this were to go into open court for all the detainees, basically the habeas corpus process would begin at the moment of their detention as opposed to when they emerge from some dark hole somewhere.
Well, in fact, this uses the case of one guy, Mr. Omari, who is the only guy in his specific situation, right? The wing of the brig in Charleston is just him. And then has issues that could open up, as you say, for hundreds of detainees. And so everything the administration did could come up. Everything could be opened up. And one of the people I talked to yesterday said, why would you foreclose your options, even options you don't think you ever want to use, in a case of one guy, when you don't know what's going to happen next? You don't know what the next attack might be. And, you know, it's people decry the Bush administration's use of these tactics in a broad way, but this fella said, you know, there might be very specific narrow ways that you might want to do it, in the way that we took actual enemy combatants during World War II and held them until the end of hostilities. There is precedent for this kind of thing, narrowly used, judiciously used, but what these experts say is it didn't happen in the last administration. But you don't want to completely foreclose your ability to use something like this in the future.
Although, without getting too abstract, isn't that what the Supreme Court has signaled, that the Bush administration's tactic of trying to have it you know, have all options open kind of indefinitely by having a military tribunal system. There are enemy combatants. There are people in other sort of nether worlds judicially. That's what the court has said. It's got to stop. It can't just be all options all the time. We've got to narrow it down. We've got to establish some precedents. Some options are going to have to be closed here.
That is precisely it. That in 2004, 2005, the Supreme Court said, you know, you can hold people, but you got to make some choices. You got to give people some rights. And so, you know, with the prospect of yet another Supreme Court decision that might narrow options still further, it's time for a trial. Mr. Almari will get a day in court.
What are you hearing from folks in the civilian courts about the prospect of dealing with this?
Well, the original charges against him, the odd behavior and the sort of weird financial dealings, were all dismissed in the deal that put him in the brig in the first place. The judge who allowed the trial to be suspended so that he could be put in this indefinite detention as an enemy combatant, he dismissed the charges with prejudice. And so those can't come up again. It's unclear what the charges will be. We'll probably get the indictment unsealed today. And the question is, you know, does the government have enough to convict? And that's the question any time the government tries to put somebody in jail.
Well, John, I guess, the question is, are there any tantalizing details that some lawyers are, you know, dying to see brought up in open court of the people that you talked with? Is there anything in this case that would reveal stuff that perhaps the Bush administration was absolutely determined would never come out?
Well, in fact, you know, some of the issues that are likely to come up are the treatment of detainees. What happened to this fella in Charleston? What happened to him during his detention? What was his treatment? There's been a lot of documentation of Mr. Almari's treatment. He's been the subject of a lot of investigative work. And, you know, there were things that some reports say were done to him, including having his mouth duct taped so he couldn't breathe, having socks stuffed in his mouth so that he couldn't talk. Being chained in a fetal position, all that stuff, it could come out in trial. It could, but not just his treatment, but how was the evidence against him obtained? This supposed meeting with Osama bin Laden, if that came through the torture of another prisoner, a prisoner at Guantanamo, is that going to be admissible? We don't generally do that in this country.
Right.
There's some very tough questions coming up here.
And there could be sources and methods in the intelligence side that also are interesting. What's the chance that Donald Rumsfeld could be called to the stand or some sort of widening view of holding the administration accountable by subpoenaing lots of witnesses?
Well, that's the lovely thing about a criminal trial. You can do all sorts of interesting things.
I was going to say, you know, what do you expect the political fallout from this is going to be?
Well, you know, the Supreme Court case was already going to be a very big deal on opening up a lot of these issues. It's you could certainly use a crowbar to open them up in the criminal case. It's certainly going to be used to you know, whether or not we have a truth commission in this country to discuss what happened to the civil rights in the United States under the Bush years, this trial and other trials like it will be mini commissions. And the lawyers who are pursuing them, I believe, will do what they can to shed light on what happened over the last 8 years.
Thank you very much, John Schwartz, national legal correspondent for The New York Times.
You're raising a really interesting idea there, the notion that the U.S. would have a truth and reconciliation process for the Bush administration. Nobody's talking about that, but that these trials might end up de facto being that sort of truth and reconciliation accountability exercise for the Bush administration. We're also talking about the economy shrinking, and the GDP number is just out, the shrinkage of 6.2%. That's how far it's down, much bigger than expected. And if you took a look at the Barack Obama budget outline yesterday, 140 pages of it, there's a pop quiz, and you can give us your results at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytakeatthetakeaway.org. Give us your impressions of the budget.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
By now, you've had a chance to read about the budget and give your impressions. The budget is being described as a priority shift. So do you think these are the right priorities? Tell us what you think at 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTake at thetakeaway.org.
Actually, we have another takeaway question this morning. Can you explain why everything is going wrong this morning on the program? 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTake at thetakeaway.org. Just call us up. We'd love to know. Just clue us in because we're kind of mystified by the whole thing. So a lot of big numbers in President Obama's budget, but there are also big ideas, a $4 trillion plan that includes major spending and major deficits as the government tries to help end the severe recession. But deep into the weeds in this budget, there are some creative ways the White House plans to pay for some of it. One of it is spending on a carbon emissions cap to raise money by capping emissions. The president says it will produce $150 billion beginning in 2012. The money would finance renewable energy projects and pay for middle-class tax credits. But in fact, the more radical idea buried in the budget is just how pervasive and extensive this emissions tax and cap is envisioned to be. John Broder is a reporter for our partner, The New York Times. He joins us. John, as you look at this emissions cap and cap and trade, and that's been discussed as an environmental policy for years now, this is something on a much bigger scale than we've seen before. Describe how it's going to scale up.
It begins at what many environmental groups and even scientific organizations think is the lower end of what needs to be done right away. President Obama proposes a 14% reduction in carbon and other greenhouse gas emissions from 2005 levels by 2020. That's a fairly flat curve upwards. But then it becomes progressively more steep, reaching 83% below 2005 levels by 2050. Now, that's a long way out in the future, but those are also fairly significant reductions along the lines of what of scientific organizations, including the UN, believe is necessary to moderate the warming of the planet. So, and because it becomes so steep, it generates a lot of money in revenues.
Well, what part of this is going to be just, you know, some kind of magical market process, and how much of this would have to be enforced, particularly at the beginning, to make sure there are enough participants to actually get those kinds of funds?
Well, the first step, and it's already begun, and there's also an additional $19 million in the budget. Now, $19 million doesn't sound like a lot, but it's a fairly new program at the Environmental Protection Agency to begin a nationwide monitoring of carbon dioxide sources. There are already such monitors in place at most power plants, but every large factory and refinery and smelting company in the country is going to have a monitor that measures that installation's output of carbon dioxide, because you can't begin to regulate and tax carbon unless you know where it's coming from.
And would this be scalable down to, say, each individual building in a city like New York or each individual residence in a suburb like Westchester County?
Well, there are some critics who think that that will be, in fact, necessary. I don't think it's practical or practicable, and there will probably be moderate-sized sources of carbon dioxide that may escape regulation, at least at first. But this scheme is intended to be economy-wide.
And if there is this vast sort of nationwide monitoring of carbon, then how would the government begin to get money from the emissions cap? And describe the cap-and-trade process and how and who would participate in it.
Well, it's both simple and devilishly complex. The idea is that anybody or any facility that emits carbon dioxide would have to buy a permit to do so. As long as you're within the cap that has been decreed for your permit, your industry, your sector of the economy, those caps produce a fairly reasonably priced emissions permit. But if you exceed it in 1 year, you're going to have to either go to the government or to another
potential source of emissions and buy a permit. This is the same kind of scheme that we use to control sulfur dioxide and nitrous oxide emissions, the so-called acid rain program that was initiated in 1990. And while critics said that that was going to be horrendously expensive and not capture the emissions, it in fact worked better than anticipated.
But could you envision a time when everyone in their car has, like, just like a catalytic converter, a carbon tester, and that every time you go in to get your registration, an inspector can basically determine how much carbon you've put into the environment and basically write you an invoice?
Well, I don't think it has to be that complex, because there's a fairly direct line between the fuel you put in your car and the emissions that come out the tailpipe. Everyone knows, not everyone, but every scientist knows, and every state regulatory agency and the EPA knows roughly the carbon content of a gallon of gasoline. So you're not really, you don't really have to measure emissions. What,
right.
what you measure is mileage per gallon.
So finally, $150 billion, is that practical? And in the political world that we live in, is there any chance that this plan can get through the Congress intact?
Well, first of all, remember the $150 billion is over 10 years. That's $15 billion a year of what are anticipated to be $80 to $100 billion in revenues from this carbon trading regime. And remember, that's on the lower end of the earlier estimates, which even the president's budget director, when he was the congressional budget director, thought could generate as much as $200 or $300 billion in revenue a year.
And it's really a drop in the budget, or drop in the bucket. I mean, it's kind of the sort of political game right there. An incremental implementation of what's going to look like in 10 years, a really, really big idea. Perhaps that's the only way to implement something like this. John Broder, thanks so much. John Broder is New York Times reporter reporting from Washington on the cap and trade emissions cap idea for getting $150 billion over 10 years in the Obama budget. And now Femi Oke has some headlines.
Thank you. The time is 28 minutes past the hour. New figures out this morning show that the economy contracted much faster than experts expected. It shrunk at a rate of 6.2%. And the Treasury Department announced today that it will increase its ownership in the bank Citigroup from 8 to 36%. The government will convert up to $25 billion of its preferred stock into common stock, and that's a riskier investment.
They get a really nice seat at the stockholders meeting then. It's great and catered. It's really wonderful for them.
Yeah, the government will have a little bit more control over Citibank this way. Boeing says that two of its employees died and another was injured when a Turkish jet crashed in Amsterdam. Altogether, nine people died on Wednesday when the flight from Istanbul crashed a few miles from Amsterdam's Schiphol Airport. And finally, do you doodle when you're bored or lose interest in a meeting?
Sometimes I do that, yeah.
Yeah. A study from the University of Plymouth says that doodling can make a dull presentation or speech easier to remember. Researchers
easier to remember, not
yes.
easier to tolerate.
Easier to remember. They tested doodlers and non-doodlers by playing them a telephone message, and the doodlers remembered more of that telephone message.
That's why I was doing it always.
Yeah, always.
That was always the reason. Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of auto insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
By now, you've had a chance to read about the budget and make your impressions. This budget is being described as a priority shift. So do you think these are the right priorities? Or maybe you wish they didn't budget so much for paper?
Hi, this is Gail in New York City. I'm wondering, if all of Congress could be twittering during the State of the Union address, I'm wondering why they had to print up copies of the budget. Couldn't they look at them electronically and save us all that paper?
I wonder how much money was spent to print that budget. I don't know. Anyway, tell us what you think about the budget at 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org.
Some daunting numbers and twittering going on regarding what's happening on Wall Street right now. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is down almost 2% in the early going on Wall Street in reaction to the larger than expected GDP number, which is out this morning. About an hour ago, the Labor Department issued the gross domestic product down 6.2%. That's a bigger rate of decline than was expected. And any indication of how much the world depends on the U.S. economy, all you have to do is look across the pond to European and markets in the U.K. They're way down this morning in response to the GDP number. Joining us now is Wall Street Journal economics reporter Kelly Evans, who helps us to dissect numbers like this on days like today. Kelly, thanks for joining us.
Sure.
This was a really big drop. I mean, they were expecting 5.4%, but what do you see in the difference between 5.4 and 6.2 that should alarm us?
Well, actually, a lot of the declines weren't in any one particular category or another, but kind of seen across the board. If you look at consumer spending, business investment, exports in particular, really the main pillars of gross domestic product all were substantially weaker than first thought, and that's because when the government's reporting this data right away, what they're doing is estimating a lot of the figures from November and December. And as that picture becomes clearer, and in this case was much worse than expected in a lot of those categories, you know, that's why they've had to revise it down so much. And a big part of this, too, is the inventory swing that happens here. You know, inventories declined at the end of last year, which sort of weighed on GDP and didn't boost, you know, the final tally by as much as it was first thought. I will say, you know, there's a silver lining in that. The more that inventories were liquidated at the end of last year, the less hopefully will need to happen now. And that could make the current quarter, which is also looking to see a pretty big fall here, you know, it does make it look perhaps a little bit better.
But these assumptions are really what's being tested here. I mean, the inventory drop also bears directly on the employment numbers. And within the GDP number, you're seeing some of the leading indicators. I mean, everybody says the gross domestic product number is a snapshot of what just happened. But if you look at business investment and the significant downturn in business investment, that affects what's going forward. Explain a little bit the significance of the business investment drop.
Absolutely. I mean, when you look down the categories here, it's pretty astonishing how many declines are in the double digits and well into them. I mean, down by 20-30%. Business investment fell by about 20%. That's huge for a quarter. Again, these are annualized rates, but we're talking about pretty big swings. And it what it suggests is that going forward, and we saw a lot of this with companies coming out of the fourth quarter when they reported results and said, look, we're trying to cut costs, we're cutting salaries, we're cutting our spending plans, we're not investing the way we want to be. So we're already seeing a little bit of that reflected, and there's no sign that that's going to let up anytime soon for a lot of these places. And what happens, again, is as you mentioned, is you get this sort of negative feedback loop where then it hurts employment and you have more of a shadow cast on the unemployment rate if companies are pulling back so much. So the forecast for unemployment, which is right now 7.6%, to rise towards double digits at the end of the year are definitely, you know, kind of in the mainstream right now.
This is Jerome Vaughn. Just a quick question. Is there any glimmer of hope in this? Anything?
Again, I would say that, look, you know, if you had more of an inventory drawdown at the end of last year, there will be people who say, you know, in turn, that means that we don't need to see as much of it in the first part of this year, and that's a better sign for growth. You know, so that's sort of the mathematics of it. But I would say, again, that the second half recovery scenario that kind of was taken as what's likely to happen really sort of relied on a big boost from the Obama stimulus package and from some other, you know, turning points in the economy that, again, we still could see over the next couple of quarters. They're not out of the question, but the, you know, whether we're sort of setting ourselves up for a recovery that is strong or, you know, sustainable, I don't know.
Well, you know, the I don't know, let's probe that a little bit. The math gets a little difficult here because when you see all these double-digit downward swings in these various sectors inside GDP, you're really beginning to describe a wholesale stockade mentality in the economy where you can't necessarily connect the dots. Things aren't happening in an incremental way. People are just sort of stopping cold, and it's really hard to predict what happens next.
Absolutely. And you know, there is one point, too, in looking for silver linings here. I mean, if we have a quarter that's where things look like they came to a standstill, well, that means, hey, if we start to get moving again, then we could really turn things around here. And that's definitely the hope that some people have at this point, is that we've come so far down, we've so overcorrected for the pain out there, that we could really, you know, be at a point where people just need to start buying again. You know, consumers have had a recession like they haven't had in decades. You know, personal saving rate is rising. There are some structural things going on here. So, you know, there is the hope that once we, you know, start moving from absolute zero, that things start moving along. Again, whether that happens in 3 or 6 months or 15, we're also trying to get a better sense of that right now.
Well, the Dow and S&P are down 2% or more at this point. Kelly Evans, we didn't even have time to talk about the Citibank story. On a normal day, the government taking a 45% stake in Citibank or thereabouts would be a huge story, but it's buried in the numbers of the economy shrinking.
Yeah, right shrinking. Now it's just more of that. Okay, great. All right.
Financial meltdown. Oh, yeah, we did that last week. Kelly Evans, Wall Street Journal economics reporter. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Femi OK has the headline.
Hello there. The time is 21 minutes to the top of the hour. Mortgage holder Fannie Mae is looking for more government support. It says that it needs $15 billion to restore its solvency. That's after posting more than $25 billion in fourth quarterly losses. In another sign of the global recession, Japan's government says that industrial production plunged 10% in January. It's the largest decline since Tokyo began keeping track of that data, and that started back in 1953. Output fell most among makers of cars, electronics, and general machinery. The Vatican says the apology by a bishop who denied the Holocaust was not good enough to admit him back into the Catholic Church as a clergyman. Last month, the ultra-conservative bishop Richard Williamson said that far fewer than 6 million Jews were killed after and during the Holocaust, and none at all were gassed. Yesterday, Williamson apologized for his comments. Forensic experts are working today to identify the dead in a Turkish Airlines crash that killed 9 people in the Netherlands. The plane's flight data and cockpit voice recordings are being analysed in Paris. And the flight was coming in from Istanbul with 135 passengers and crew when it crashed near Amsterdam's Schiphol Airport. And that's a look at big stories making news this morning.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Jerome Vaughn.
And I'm John Hockenberry with a thought on another news story. We live in an era of pixels. Small rectangular units that, when taken together, create an image. We see the dots in impressionist paintings sometimes, in printed photos and images. You go in close, you see the dots. Closer, and it's only dots. Pull back, and the dots become grains, become invisible. Your eye actually stops seeing the dots altogether and knits the pixels back together into an image. Reality, truth, or the brain's approximation of reality and truth. It's all we have, really, this approximation. We're always a bit removed from this absolute truth. It's the pixels that keep us at bay. But our eyes are sensitive. 17,000 dots per inch. That's the resolution of the human eye. Remove even a single dot and the eye can register it. Remove 1,000 pixels, the eye blinks. Remove 4,000 and there's something wrong. Clearly, the image breaks down. Reality has a hole in it.
There's a place they call Dover, where the bodies come in.
There are 4,253 pixels missing from our collective image of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. That's the number of rectangular, flag-draped coffins that have been brought into Dover Air Force Base, Delaware. The number of the U.S. dead in those wars.
No, they don't want it known.
We have not been permitted to see those coffins because of a Pentagon ban on media coverage that dates back 18 years to the George H.W. Bush presidency. The media, it was thought, used the images to malign the commander-in-chief. and the gravitas of the flag-draped coffins was a private domain of the bereaved families, not some grist for opportunistic news organizations. Perhaps the ban made some sense then, but now as this ban ends, the announcement came from Defense Secretary Robert Gates yesterday, we can ask ourselves, what has been missed? What precisely does this somber image of war signify? It's not like the flag-draped coffin of a world leader, a president who is known by all who see it. Nor is it like a tomb of the unknowns, a marker for a body known by no one. No, each box holds the body of a soldier, Marine, seaman, airman, known by some family. They hold the grief. We watch silently. It's pure empathy, one pixel at a time, an empathy we have been excluded from for all these years. And now the pixels return. With the ban lifted, the broad image of a nation's loss resolves. The eye recomposes the image for us. Not absolute reality exactly, but closer. We know the resolution of the human eye. Perhaps with the restoration of these pixels, we have a chance to learn the resolution of the human heart.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. Some guidance for your weekend coming up. Maybe you'll need it with the markets doing what they're doing this morning. Both the Dow and the S&P are down about 2%. But we've got some headlines now from Femi Okeh.
Hello there. Coming up to 12 minutes to the top of the hour, the economy shrank at a rate of 6.2% last quarter. It's the worst showing in a quarter of a century. The president will be in North Carolina today to announce his plans to withdraw from Iraq with the American troops. They should be out by August of 2010. In a closed-door meeting yesterday, the president told Republican and Democratic leaders that up to 50,000 troops will stay behind. The leader of Israel's centrist party, Zipi Livni, says that she won't join a government led by conservative Benjamin Netanyahu. He's Israel's prime minister-designate. They've been in talks to discuss forming a coalition, but Livni says they ended without agreement on key issues. I've just been looking at the online edition of the Rocky Mountain News. It's the last edition. The headline is Goodbye, Colorado. Colorado is saying goodbye to its newspaper after 150 years. Have a listen to one of the staff members reporting online today.
Even when you know that somebody's going to hit you in the stomach real hard for 2 months, when they do it, it still hurts.
Last year, the Rocky Mountain News lost $16 million. The newspaper was one of only two dailies in Denver.
Thanks very much, Femi. All this morning, we're thinking about President Obama's proposed budget and want you to weigh in. It's being described as a priority shift. So do you think these are the right priorities? Andrea emails us, this administration is only a nice version of the last one. Even during the Reagan admin, there wasn't NAFTA. Tell us what you think about the budget at 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, Allison Williams. The fans go wild when Allison Williams, features editor at Time Out New York, enters our studio. Thanks for joining us, Allison.
No problem. They follow me everywhere I go. What can I do about it? It's
so
a tough life.
Annoying. Well, you are here to tell us some things that we can think about for this weekend. And those screaming fans out there are screaming for someone that you're here to talk about.
Exactly. They're screaming for the Jonas Brothers, which if you have a 13-year-old girl, you probably know who they are.
I have two 10-year-olds and a 7-year-old. Yeah. I know who the Jonas Brothers are.
Well, they have a 3D movie coming out, a concert movie this weekend. And this is the type of thing that if you like the Jonas Brothers, you're going to love the movie. And if you don't really love the Jonas Brothers, maybe this is not the weekend to go out and see.
So it kind of works like this, right? The Jonas Brothers have a 3D movie, Allison?
I mean, it's what I did.
Now, just for people who don't know the Jonas Brothers, explain exactly what the conceit is here.
Sure. They are three brothers. They're in their late teens and early 20s. They perform on the Disney Channel. They've done a lot of stuff with Hannah Montana, Miley Cyrus, that whole crowd. The High School Musical kids are going to enjoy the Jonas Brothers.
So it's kind of like, you know, Hannah Montana, but with guys.
Yes, with boys.
So, and there we go.
It's really very PG. It's good for kids.
Very PG. Good for kids. All right. Besides the Jonas Brothers, what's coming out this weekend that we can go and see?
You know, there aren't a lot of big movies coming out this weekend. I think now's the time to go catch up on stuff that you haven't seen. If you watched the Oscars last weekend and thought, oh, I meant to go out and see Slumdog Millionaire or The Curious Case of Benjamin Button, those things are going to be leaving the theaters pretty quickly to make room for all the big summer stuff in the next couple of months.
All right. Well, then, you know, everyone's going to be checking this out, right?
It's getting hot in here.
Are you nervous?
What? Am I nervous? It's you who's in the hot seat, my friend.
Oh, yes.
Of course, that's a scene from Slumdog Millionaire, which got 8 Oscars this week. You know, do you think Slumdog Millionaire, for people who haven't seen it, who like listened to all the hype all week long, do you think this movie sustains the hype? In other words, is it a better movie to go and see if you don't know that much about it or if you've heard all the hype?
You know, I think if you've heard all the hype, it's going to deliver pretty much what you expected. It's bright, it's colorful, it's got some serious parts, and it's got some fun parts. So I think it's going to be rewarding for people who've heard a lot of the hype.
What about the movies that people haven't seen? Say, for instance, Kate Winslet's two movies, The Reader and Revolutionary Road. Right?
Those are both very serious movies. I think you want to go into it knowing that you're in for a thoughtful evening. But they're also both very rewarding. However, they can also wait for DVD.
Right. And Benjamin Button, is that a wait for DVD, do you think?
You know, that's actually a really beautiful movie. It won for visual effects, for makeup, for art direction. That's maybe something you want to go see on the big screen because it's so lush and so gorgeous.
So a recommendation, actually, to see Benjamin Button. Mm-hmm. That's interesting. All right. So let's say we're just going to stay at home. You've got how many kids, Jerome?
Seven.
I've got 4. So you got a couple of stay-at-home dads that you're looking at here, Allison.
Well, there's a DVD set that came out a couple of weeks ago that I just love, a show called Dead Like Me that was on Showtime a couple of years ago. And this is it's a really fun comedic drama. It's about a bunch of grim reapers that hang around dealing with dead people.
So fun, comedic television series called Dead Like Me.
I'm going to get a pet bird.
And what are you going to do with a bird?
Stick it in a cage and feed it. What do you think I'm going to do with it?
Well, I think you should at least get one you can eat.
I'm going to get a friend. I'm not going to eat my friend.
So this is the workaday world of Grim Reapers who have to go around the world and tell people that they're dead.
Exactly. It's being a Grim Reaper is kind of like jury duty. You don't pick when you're chosen to do it, and you don't really have much of a choice. And they're fun characters. They're grumpy, which is a good group to hang out with if you're having a stay-at-home kind of feeling grumpy kind of day.
And this only had 1 season, right?
It had about 2 seasons.
2 seasons, okay.
And there's also a made-for-DVD movie that comes along with the set. So there's some new stuff in there, and it's just a great rainy day activity.
So Dead Like Me, that's a recommendation. What about on TV, regular old sort of, you know, non-plug-in TV?
Right. Well, this Monday, a show called Harlem Heights is going to premiere on BET. And it's kind of like The Hills, if you're familiar with that at all. It's a documentary-ish that's following a bunch of young people as they live their sort of fabulous, wonderful lives.
It's a reality show, kind of MTV-like, but in a sort of BET take.
Yes, very similar. Although I have to say a little more serious. It follows them. It starts on the night of the 2008 election, and you see a little bit more real emotion, real drama than you do at The Hills.
Maybe Jerome's family would be a reality show.
It would be a pretty wacky reality show.
We could put
some
cameras in there. We should try to pitch that to BET.
I would wait on that one. Wait till that comes out on video.
All right. So as far as other television options are concerned, you've actually thought about an old favorite here. And let's hear a little bit.
Hi. Is Dr. Morris around?
Are you a family member?
I'm John Carter.
Uh-huh.
Used to work here.
Oh. As what?
That's from ER.
Right. Now, ER's been on a little while. It's been about 15 years now.
It's like Gunsmoke or something. Yeah, it's amazing how long it's been on.
Exactly. But, you know, it's coming to an end this year. It's going to end on April 2nd. And they're really sending it out with a bang. They're bringing back a lot of old actors. That was Noah Wiley. George Clooney is going to be making...
Clooney's going to come back?
He's making an appearance, which shows that he knows where he came from and he's willing to come back and show up. And the show has had some ups and downs, but it's coming out on a high note, I think. And it's always been a very... interesting hospital drama, and it's influenced so many other shows.
Quickly, music, video games?
Well, we got U2 coming up with a new album, No Line on the Horizon. I don't know if you've heard of U2, a little bar band from Dublin. They get around sometimes.
It's the guy with the guitar, a band with the guitarist with a weird name.
Right, exactly. Bono
Blade.
Would be a little sad that you... But, you know, it's going to be huge. It sounds exactly like what you'd expect from U2. I think it's not going to surprise anybody, but it's not really going to disappoint anybody.
Rolling Stone gave it a huge review.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and you have a video game recommendation.
Right, there's a game called Flower for PlayStation 3. It's the kind that you can download rather than having to go out and buy. And rather than a shoot 'em up or, you know, World War II style game, this is a really beautiful, lush, visual, relaxing, kind of like a Zen video game.
All right. Well, all of your suggestions will be on our website. And I guess it's safe to say that we are in the Netherworld before Watchmen comes out, right?
A little excited there?
I am so excited about Watchmen. I am the biggest Watchmen fan
right.
in the universe.
Comes out on the 6th, Friday, March 6th, and I'm very excited.
Be excited. Together with us, Allison Williams, features editor at Time Out New York. Thanks so much for joining us. Go, Jerome.
I'm Jerome Vaughn from WDET in Detroit, in for Adora Udoji. All this morning, we're thinking about President Obama's proposed budget and want you to weigh in. It's being described as a priority shift. So do you think these are the right priorities? Tell us your thoughts at our website, thetakeaway.org.
And we got your takeaway this morning.
In looking for silver linings here, I mean, if we have a quarter where things look like they came to a standstill, well, that means, hey, if we start to get moving again, then we could really turn things around here.
She tried, and she found a silver lining. That's the Wall Street Journal's Kelly Evans talking about the staggering GDP shrinking 6.2% at the end of 2008, the worst showing in 25 years. If you missed anything, take our podcast to go. Subscribe now at thetakeaway.org. While you're there, check out the great responses we've been getting on the grammar and punctuation errors America wants to correct, and you can add your own. And you'll see some responses from people in the Detroit area. I want to give a big thanks to Jerome Vaughn for joining me all this week for our inaugural broadcast in our newest city, Detroit. He's been great. We can't wait to talk more about all the stories affecting your city and to welcome all of the Detroiters into the conversation. And so many have joined already.
Thanks, John. I'm Jerome Vaughn from WDET in Detroit.
I'm John Hockenberry. This is the Have a Good Weekend Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.